You are born to fly, and in dreams you recover your wings. In dreaming, flying is a natural human ability. Doesn't it feel great? Perhaps you've had that experience of flying in a dream, of leaving the limitations and restrictions of everyday life behind, of going beyond the limits of the body and of space-time. This is a practice you can learn. You can become a frequent flyer. It's a great adventure. In fact, it's a limitless adventure. If you're going to become a frequent flyer in your dreams and explore all the rich territory of dreaming, you don't want to turn to anyone as an expert on the subject. There are no experts on dreaming. You are the expert on your own dreams. What you might want to do is to turn to a frequent flyer who knows the air conditions, knows the mood of the natives in some of the dream countries you might visit, and can tell you what it's been like recently. The best people to look to for guidance on dreams are people who dream a lot, people who dream profusely, and who work with their dreams. It's interesting that the most widespread word for shaman in the Western Hemisphere means literally one who dreams. Amongst the Mohawk Indians, the word is Radzetzots. It means one who dreams, implying one who dreams a lot, an active dreamer who does interesting things with dreams, who dreams for the benefit of other people, who knows dream territories and travels there frequently. How do you learn about this practice? You learn basically by doing it. And in these sessions, I hope to share with you some simple and powerful techniques that you can use to enrich your life and spread your wing feathers. I'd like to introduce these sessions by saying a little bit about myself, because I agree with Mark Twain when he says, I don't want to hear about the moon from someone who hasn't been there. I start as a dreamer. I'm not an expert, you are the expert on your own dreams. And by the way, the most important book on dreams you will ever read is your own dream journal. But my fascination with the dream worlds springs from my earliest childhood in my native Australia. I dreamed a lot. I was challenged by many life-threatening illnesses. I had pneumonia in both lungs 12 times by the age of 11. We didn't talk about near-death experiences in those days in Australia. I thought of it as dying and coming back, and the gift of all the time spent in the silence and solitude of sick rooms was an inner life that was wonderfully rich and strange, encounters with dream characters and dream-like situations that really haunted and shaped my life and finally gave me keys of healing. These dream experiences introduced dream guides to me who became important spiritual teachers in my life. One of them first appeared to me when I was 7 years old. He called himself Philemon. I'd never heard of Jung or Jung's vision guide Philemon as a seven-year-old Australian kid. But my Philemon, who appeared as a radiant young man from the eastern edge of the Mediterranean, circa second or third century of the Christian era, taught me about healing, about the use of the caduceus, about the philosophic concepts of the Neoplatonist school of philosophers. Rich gifts. My problem as a child is one that perhaps you have known at some point in your life. I didn't have anyone I could share these things safely with, not in my school, not in my church, not in my family. People didn't seem to dream the way that I did, or if they did, they didn't let on about it, which is strange because we all dream. Everyone dreams on average at least 2 hours a night, and that's just going by the REM state sleep, you know, the sleep that the people in white coats and laboratories can gauge by measuring the movement of your eyeballs behind your eyelids, only one phase of dreaming. We all dream. Yet in the very conservative age in which I grew up in Australia, people didn't talk about dreams. They didn't talk about spiritual encounters. The first person I met in my life who could validate for me the reality of dreaming and its role as a key to identity and purpose in life was a person from a different culture, a person from a dreaming tradition. He was an Aboriginal boy. I met him when I was about six in Brisbane, Australia. When I talked about my dreams of ancestor figures, departed relatives, and other things my society held strange, Jacko, my Aboriginal friend, who was a little bit older than me, would say very matter-of-factly, "Oh, yeah, I went into the dreaming, and I saw my grandmother, who's been gone for 10 years, and she told my mother what to take for her sciatica." So what was I hearing from a boy from a different tradition, from a dreaming tradition? I was hearing that from the point of view of his culture, it's not weird to dream of departed people, and you don't psychologize that kind of thing away by saying, well, you're thinking of some aspect of yourself or it's some kind of wish fulfillment. From the point of view of his tradition, it's perfectly natural to receive guidance from departed loved ones in dreams. Why shouldn't they communicate with us that way? And when it came to other aspects of dreaming, I heard similarly revelatory things to me, revelatory and validating things. He told me about his uncle, a painter, who, when he wasn't painting gum trees and koalas for the tourists, would go into the dreaming to get the inspiration for the paintings that recalled the ancestors and the creation time, the paintings that were not for the tourists. So I was hearing from a dreaming tradition that through dreams we can put ourselves in touch with our creative source. In fact, I've come to believe that the source of dreams and the source of our deepest creativity are one and the same. But at that stage in my life, I needed to go amongst a different people to learn from a different tradition, amongst an indigenous people that value dreams and honor dreamers, to hear what has been natural knowledge, surely, for humankind since our very beginnings. I've become convinced that dreaming is one of the defining characteristics of human beings. It was part of our survival process when we were naked apes being hunted by the whole physical counterpart of the menagerie of Jurassic Park. I mean, how did we dare to sleep as naked apes with primitive weapons? Back in prehistoric times, we could afford to sleep and manage to stay alive because through our natural dream radar, we were able to scan our external environment for dangers and see the saber-toothed tiger before it ate us for breakfast. At this later stage in our evolution, on the cusp of the millennium, I think that dreaming holds the key to our evolution into a more generous and more spirited version of ourselves. Dreaming is one of the keys to the emergence of the multidimensional human, capable of operating on multiple levels of consciousness, recognizing her or his relationship with other species and responsibilities to the planet. Let me say a little bit more about the dreams that have been watersheds in my life. When I moved to the United States back in the 1980s, I started dreaming in a language not my own, a language I did not know. I'd moved to Upper New York State to get away from big cities and discover myself and put down some roots in my adopted country. And now through my dreams came figures from a tradition I did not recognize. I found myself entering a conscious dream one night and flying a very physical sensation on the wings of a red-tailed hawk, catching the air currents, flying over a lake northward towards Canada, drawn down to a cabin in the woods where an ancient native woman spoke to me beautifully, musically, mysteriously for what seemed like hours while she spread strings and belts of wampum beads on the ground between us. I didn't know what she was saying. I was intent on her bright eyes, the keenness of her knowledge, but I didn't know her words. It was not one of those dreams in which you know what people who are obviously of a different language and tradition are saying. It was a dream in which the message was partly that in order to understand, I needed to expand my knowledge, expand my vocabulary, learn a new language. I came back from the dream tantalized, unsatisfied, not knowing what I was being told. I wrote down, scratched down phonetically a few words from the dream encounter. She came again in dreams, or called me again in dreams, and then I met some Mohawk speakers, and when I showed them what I had been learning through these dreams, they said as matter-of-factly, as my Aboriginal friend had said to me in childhood, "Oh, well, I guess you had some visits." They told me that some great ones of their people stay close to the earth after physical death to watch over the earth and the people, and they might talk to an outsider like me, my Iroquois friend said, because you seem to dream the way we used to dream, so they might talk to you. Well, this began to put me on another path of dreaming and brought about contact with another dreaming tradition outside the mainstream Western tradition. It led to a point in my life where I had a watershed dream, and I'd like to share this one with you as part of my introduction. I reached a point of some confusion in my life. My waking ego with its commercial agendas and petty concerns was pretty much in the way of my path of soul. It's a juncture many of us reach. And I asked for a dream to guide me amongst the many choices that were in my path. In my dream, I found myself traveling into a wood, hell-bent on finding the original object of my dream, which looked like an enormous coffee pot set up on stilts. I was looking for guidance on writing a commercial pot boiler. And there is a coffee pot up on stilts, and I think I'm going to get my guidance. Funny, silly kind of dream. But suddenly, in the midst of this wooded scene, a tremendously powerful entity or energy seizes me, invisible like a Chinese wind dragon, and pulls me backwards away from the object I have chosen, drawing me away from my waking purpose. I'm conscious I'm dreaming. I know I don't have to go with this intent, this energy, but I decide to go with its flow. And I allow myself to be drawn backwards, backwards, away from the object of my waking desires. And I find myself among a circle of people who live very close to the earth. I feel a little uneasy. Am I intruding on some native ritual? Am I an outsider who does not belong here? They welcome me. They show me they have a place ready for me. I sit with them. I chant with them. I drum with them. And after a time when the fire becomes friendly, I move to the center of the circle and I lie in its center. And the earth people do something very curious. They gather red-hot coals from the fire. And they lay the red-hot coals over my eyes and over my ears. And they place one on my tongue. And they place one over my heart. And they say in musical cadenced speech, "We do this to change your eyes that you may see truly. We do this to change your ears that you may hear clearly. We do this to change your mouth that you may speak only the truth. And we do this," placing the coal over your heart, "to open the passage from your heart to your mouth so that henceforth you will speak and act only from the heart." Well, I didn't do any dream interpretation with that dream. I woke up charged with energy, full of juice, full of electricity. I jumped into my car. I drove to a lake I could reach easily from my house. And in the soft rain, I said to the lake, to the trees, to the clouds, the red-tailed hawk that came knifing through those clouds, "As a self-offering, henceforth I will speak and act only from the heart." Now I wish to you a dream of this quality, not the same dream, it will be your own dream, but I wish for you a dream that may inspire and warm your life, as that dream has inspired and warmed and fed mine. In my down moments, when I feel confused or distracted, I go back to that dream, and it's like a hearth fire where I can warm myself, and it's like a beacon I can follow. It gave me a definition of purpose that I've really never lost sight of since. So I think perhaps I've already conveyed one of the gifts of dreaming. There are many gifts of dreaming, but one of the great gifts of dreaming is this. Through dreaming, we can remember the deeper purpose of our lives and walk the path of soul and spirit with the courage and passion that it requires. Perhaps we need to spend a moment thinking about what the word dream or dreaming means. We have a rather impoverished understanding of what dreams mean in our culture. A kid wakes up in the middle of the night and the parents say, "Go back to sleep, honey, it's only a dream," which really distresses children because they know that dreams are real experiences, whether their parents understand that or not. So we say, "Only a dream," or "in your dreams," implying that's something that can never happen. On the other hand, we do talk about dreams as wishes of the soul, which is part of the traditional understanding of dreams amongst indigenous peoples. We say, "I dream of getting a new automobile, or a perfect mate, or a perfect job. I dream of finding myself. I dream of being healed." That's a deeper meaning of dreaming, and a valid one. In languages from other cultures, particularly from dreaming traditions, we see a fuller spectrum of meaning that might be involved in the concept of dreams and dreaming. In the language of the shamanic people of Venezuela, the Mequiritari, for example, the word for dream, adakato, means literally a flight of the soul. What is implied here? What is implied is not only that dreams are real experiences, but that dreams might be more real in some ways than much of waking life, because in dreams the soul is loosed from the body to travel into the spiritual realms and have contact with spiritual teachers, ancestors, and so on. In the language of an Australian Aboriginal people, The word for dream also means big story, big narrative, and spiritual visitor. So the teaching implied in the language itself is that a dream is not just a dream. A dream is a big story, maybe a story big enough for you to find the story of your life inside it and enlarge your purpose. And a dream might also involve a visit from a spiritual entity. As a matter of fact, amongst indigenous peoples, big dreams are regarded as coming about in one of two ways. If you're having a big dream, there are big dreams and little dreams. It's a bit like watching things on TV, isn't it? You get a commercial for gas, and then you get a news flash about a possible world war, and then you get an episode of a long-running soap. There are big and little dreams. And shamanic peoples distinguish big and little dreams just as we do, intuitively, viscerally. But if you're having a big dream in the view of a traditional people, it's for one of two reasons. Either you are having a flight of the soul, you're out of your body, you're released from the limits of space-time, you can travel to the spiritual realms, you can very easily and naturally track forward in time, scouting round the corner, seeing challenges that lie ahead on the path of your life. From this point of view, it's perfectly natural to dream the future before it happens. Or alternatively, if you're having a big dream, it's because you have received a visitation from a being that is not confined to a physical body. It might be another dreamer. It might be a spiritual teacher. It might be an angel. It might be an ancestor. That's how big dreams come about in the view of shamanic peoples and cultures that value dreams, where often the first business of the day for the family or even the whole community is to gather together and share dreams, because dreams are understood to be life-empowering, life-supporting, sometimes life-preserving, and also it's wonderful fun and it's great adventure. So we need to expand our definition of dreaming. And it needs to include some of those understandings that I've cited from traditional peoples that have continued to value dreams, while in our Western culture we have often disparaged them. The gifts of dreaming come in many ways. I will always treasure the spontaneous wisdom of the sleep dream that comes unasked for. A gift of the night. It takes us to deeper places than we can go in what Yeats called the trivial everyday mind. But this is only one of the ways in which we receive the gifts of dreaming. In addition to our spontaneous sleep dreams, we have experiences on the cusp of sleep, between waking and sleeping in the hypnagogic zone, or between sleeping and waking in the so-called hypnopompic zone. And in this twilight zone, many important messages come through. As a matter of fact, the twilight zone between sleep and waking is a wonderful, wonderful sandbox for dream explorers and much underrated as a place of learning and adventure. So we have, let us call them, the twilight zone dreams in the hypnagogic zone. Then we have the dreams in which we ask for guidance through incubation. You can go to your dream source with a question or a request and catch what it brings you. So we have the incubated dream. Then we have the conscious dream journey beyond those floating, sometimes very fluid twilight zone experiences. We have dream journeys on which you embark from a waking state in which you can go through a gateway and have a dream adventure. Visit a place or a person you wish to visit, seek the sources of healing or creativity. Explore the nature of the imaginal realm, the nature of the dream world, which has its own laws and forms and conditions. Examine, perhaps, the source of many of the events that will later be manifested in your physical life. We have the shamanic soul journey, facilitated often by monotonous shamanic drumming, in which you may embark upon a conscious dream journey beyond the body. You may shapeshift in your dream body into the form of a bird or animal close to you, and you may travel through the many levels of the shamanic universe. And finally, in listing these different ways of dreaming and working with dreams, we mustn't forget to do dream work with the symbols and synchronicities of waking life, because our waking life, the point of view of many spiritual masters, is also a dream. And the patterns and events around you in physical life will speak to you in the manner of dream symbols if you will only learn to pay attention. To pay attention means literally to stretch yourself. Attendere in Latin is to stretch. So to pay attention means to stretch your comprehension, enlarge your understanding. We need, in fact, to take dreams more literally and waking life more symbolically. Let me share another personal adventure with you that will bring alive several of these levels and gifts of dreaming. It's a dream in which I moved from one type of dream into another. Perhaps you've had a dream like that, in which you've moved from an outer courtyard of dreaming into an inner courtyard. In the first part of my dream, I'm in a lecture theatre, not exactly an unusual environment for me, and I'm very frustrated because the seats are bolted to the floor and there's no possibility of grouping people informally, as I like to do, and having people move around with flow and spontaneity. And in my dream, I become aware that I'm dreaming, and I think it's probably time to wake myself up from this dream and figure out what lecture theatre I need to have changed in my waking life and do something with the dream. But I shift into another dream. I move from one dream into a deeper level of dreaming. And suddenly everything is hyper-alive, hyper-vivid. The colors are tremendously rich and bold. I am on a white beach and the sun is beating down on the whiteness of the sand. And I see from the blue sky above me a blur of feathers. And a tremendous bird lands on my head and tries to pluck from my head my Australian hat. Well, I decide I'm going to hold on to my hat. I wrestle with this bird. I see the hook of its beak, its yellow eye. I feel that the stab of pain as one of its talons sinks into the web between my thumb and forefinger. We roll together on the sand. Tremendously tactile, tremendously sensuous, tremendously alive. I know this bird. I don't want to hurt him. I know this bird is connected with me. It is a sea eagle, native to the north coast of Queensland, where I spent the happiest years of my childhood. And I know this bird is no adversary. I don't know why he's on my case, or specifically on my hat, but I don't want to hurt him. I wake from this dream with its message unresolved, and start telling the people in the unsatisfactory dream theater about my encounter with the sea eagle, and then I wake up. This is the first part of the dream story I want to share with you now. I understood one part of what was going on. I understood I had an advisory of a fairly literal, mundane nature about a small challenge developing in my life, and I was able to work with that. Quite specifically, I figured out what lecture theatre I was going to go to, where the seats might be arranged in a way that dissatisfied me, and I was able to have the lecture theatre changed. The lecture theatre, never previously viewed by me, was the one I had seen in my dream. So that was useful. It's a kind of useful little dream you can learn to use in your own life to scout out challenges that lie around the corner and change the future when you don't like it. This is a very practical approach, and we're going to work with it in depth. But the other aspect of the dream, the more numinous and the more powerful aspect of the dream, I did not understand. Why was a bird I knew and loved trying to steal my Australian hat? I could do all sorts of psychologizing work with that. But since I've taken to following a very traditional, old-fashioned, shamanic way of dreaming, I decided that since the eagle was my friend, he would probably come back and tell me himself. And indeed he did. He came back to me in a conscious dream when I was lying in the cusp between waking and sleep, landed on my shoulder, helped to lift me out of my physical body, and escorted me on a dream journey all the way across the continent of North America, across the Rockies, across the Pacific Ocean, and brought me down into a building I did not recognize in my native Australia, where I had a loving reunion with my mother, whom I had not seen for quite a while. And in the dream, aware I'm dreaming, I thought, this is great. There have been some problems between us. I want to get out of my dream now and call my mother and honor this dream in my waking life. But once again, I was drawn into a deeper level of dreaming. Another animal I've known since my Australian childhood appeared and guided me into the deep interior of Australia. I didn't know where I was going. I came out on a muddy creek, and I'm looking down into the muddy creek, and there's an immense creature writhing, coiling, thrashing in the water. I don't know what it is. It could be a fish. It could be a snake. It's enormous. I don't know what it is. I'm confused. I'm slightly scared. And I look about me for guidance in the dream, and next to me I see an elderly Aboriginal man painted for corroboree with circles and spirals on his skin, and he says to me, in this magical voice, haunting voice, lyrical voice, he says, "This is the way it all began. This is the first of all creatures." And I wake up thrilled, charged, energized, but I don't know what it means. Now, as with the previous dream, I have two things to work with. One of them is straightforward and really quite wonderful. I had a message through my dream guide, my sea eagle, to get in touch with my mother, and I'm very glad I did, because 3 months later she died suddenly, and this dream was one of the things that helped to prepare me for the passage of a close, loved relative. When I went back to Australia, and only then, I began to unravel the more mysterious dream, the dream of the half-fish, half-snake thing in the mud of the Aboriginal on the bank of the muddy creek. After dealing with the funeral and some of the grieving, I did an Australian thing. I went walkabout for a while, no fixed agenda, open to the play of accident, coincidence, trying to find something of myself in the country where I was born, where my fascination with the dream worlds began. And I found myself through a chain of apparent accidents and coincidences in the middle of nowhere, in a dusty town in southwestern Queensland, at an Aboriginal housing cooperative, where I started talking to dreams, and they said to me, "Oh, hold on, you better talk to the spirit man. He's the one to talk to about dreams." Well, the shaman shows himself soon afterwards. We go off and talk. He's cautious, sniffing me out, literally sniffing me out. Aboriginals have not lost their olfactory senses. Sniffing me, is this another white guy come to rip off traditional culture? And after a while, to break the ice, I start telling him my dream, the dream I do not understand, the dream of the half-fish, half-snake thing in the mud. And his eyes become bright as opals, and he's very quiet and very still for a time. And then he says, matter-of-factly, "Oh yeah, I guess you came to us for a reason," he says. "Amongst my tribe, the Mananjali tribe, we say that the bull eel, the thing you described in the muddy creek, is the first of all creatures. We say this in our sacred initiation story, which is told only to made men of the tribe. So since you dreamed it, I guess you're here for a reason." So once again, through dreaming, I was called or recalled to levels of knowing and levels of connectedness beyond ethnicity, beyond class, beyond culture. This is another of the great gifts of dreaming. It connects us with our counterparts on the level of soul, beyond ordinary reality. It teaches us the interrelatedness of all creatures. In our dreams, we can understand other people, other species, in their own realities. It calls us to a deeper life. But in terms of the challenges of our lives today, in terms of the challenges of the societies in which we live, one of the great gifts of dreaming is simply this, that it is a constant teaching in our interconnectedness. I like to tell you a story about this of a slightly different kind. Perhaps you've had a dream like this yourself, a dream in which you find yourself in the circumstances of another person and learn from that. A woman dreamer wrote to me from Texas that she became aware she was dreaming one night when she noticed that her body was different. She looked down and noticed that instead of her regular legs, she had the very long, muscular legs of a black athlete, maybe a basketball player, a male athlete. She found this, actually, tremendously exciting in the dream. She was enjoying the very sensory experience of being inside the body, inside the skin and bones of a different person. Then, in the dream, and she became aware that she was dreaming because of the anomaly, as you may have become aware that you are dreaming because of something that's out of kilter inside the dream space. And noticing this change in herself, she walks down the street. The city seems to be New Orleans. She runs into a couple of white men who display reflex racism. And then an inner voice, or a voice inside the dream, says to leave the dream before you succumb to rage. And she comes out of the dream. And she wrote to me, "You know, if we could only all share and remember the experience of being inside someone else's skin, inside someone else's situation, we would have an instant antidote to prejudice and misunderstanding between different sectors of society." I think she's right. So this, in social terms, becomes one of the gifts of dreaming too. Let's be very clear about one thing. We all dream. Anyone who tells you, "I don't dream," is telling you only, "I don't remember." Why is it then that there are many of us in our society who do not admit to dreaming, who do not share dreams, who have never bothered to keep a dream journal, who have shut out this immense territory for adventure? Well, there have been cultural influences that have worked against dreaming. In the days of intolerance, some of our religious institutions demonized half the cosmos and denied personal access to the sacred realms, claiming that dreams were the gift of Satan or something along those lines. I hope we've passed well out of those dark ages. In more recent times, probably the influence of scientism has been equally deadening. I'm not talking about science. The great scientists have always been dreamers. Look at Einstein, who attributed many of his breakthroughs to states of reverie or conscious dream. Look at Niels Bohr, who thanked his dreams when he accepted his Nobel Prize for the keys to his discovery. Great scientists have always been dreamers. But we have ideologues of an impoverished, materialistic science who reduce the mind to the brain and the brain to a computer made of meat and tell us that dreams are simply random neuronal functioning or a chemical wash in the brain, and presume to describe the process of dreaming without admitting to having crossed any comments on dreaming from people who will not share their own dreams with you and validate themselves in that way. So we've had these malign cultural influences. Hopefully we are getting beyond them. In our individual lives, there are things that get in the way of our dreaming. Fear is a big one. We suppose that our dreams are telling us that we're going to get sick, we're going to lose our job, we're going to have marriage problems, we're going to die. And scared of these possibilities, we slam the door on our dreams. It's a foolish move. Because it's like this, I think. Our dream source is on our side. And because it's a friend, it brings us messages about things we need to attend to in a timely fashion, often in a quite gentle way. If we ignore the messages, it will come back with more dramatic or violent language. If we continue to run away, we will remember these dream messages as nightmare threats that leave us with our heart beating like a terrified bird in a cage, that clammy sweat. So we run away from our nightmares. And if you go on running away from your nightmares, guess what? Eventually, the same issues will come at you in waking life and bite you in the rear end. It's like that. The dream source is our friend. It is on our side, not on our case. So if our dreams are showing us challenging things from our lives, let's brave up to the possibility that by meeting the messenger instead of ignoring or killing the messenger, we can get timely advice which might help us to work our way towards a more favorable outcome. If we're going to die, we can at least prepare for the transition. It's never too early or too late in life to do that. Maybe we won't get sick if we attend to dream warnings about getting sick before the doctors can find any symptoms. As a matter of fact, if we really want to cut health costs, we would introduce dream training, dream work in every clinic and community center in every Western society, because dreams tell us about what is likely to go wrong in our bodies before doctors can find those signs. Dream talk is body talk as well as soul talk, and that's perfectly natural. So fear is something that gets in our way, and the way to deal with our fears, really, is to brave up, to go back into our dreams, confront those adversaries and those issues on their own grounds, and dialogue with them. We will deal with this as a technique in later sessions. Medication gets in the way of some people, and sometimes it's going to be a tough call. Are you going to take a break from your medication sometimes? I'm not counseling you without medical advice, of course. But sometimes you have to ask yourself what the costs of medication that interferes with the dreaming process may be. Of course, there are drug or drug-like infusions that interfere in unprescribed ways. Alcoholics are often severely dream-deprived. They compensate with hallucinations in waking life, which is no part of what we are recommending in these sessions. But beyond all these reasons why some of us have been missing our dreams, there is the central phenomenon that dreaming has not been honored and celebrated as an activity in our culture. In traditional indigenous societies, by contrast, dreamers are revered. There's a shamanic people of Peru, the Kashinawa, who say that A person becomes truly powerful, truly full of power in life, by stalking and catching dreams. And the person who brings back more and more of the big dreams becomes a powerful person. We lost that. We need to bring it back. We need to become a dreaming society again. You can play your part. As you become a dreamer, you change things about you in extraordinarily rich and positive ways. You can learn to dream with and for others. I've been working with my personal dream journals for more than 30 years, and I'm still learning about the treasures they contain. When I think about what dreaming has meant for me and what it has meant for the many people who have come to my workshops and participated in my dream circles around the world, I notice instances where dreams have provided absolutely vital guidance, both practical and spiritual, at all the passages of life. We can look to dreaming in all the senses I've described it for guidance, both practical and spiritual, in the face of all our life challenges. Let me mention some aspects which we will be exploring as techniques that you can work with in your everyday life in the sessions that follow. First of all, through dreaming, we can rehearse the challenges that lie ahead on the road of life. There are shamans who believe we dream absolutely everything before it is manifested in physical life. Even if we find that somewhat hard to swallow given our cultural paradigms, isn't it worth working with the hypothesis that it is quite natural for us to dream about issues that are looming on the horizon in waking life, that it is entirely possible that through spontaneous dreams as well as through conscious dreams, we might be able to get quite specific information about things that lie around the corner? And wouldn't it be rational and sensible to try to use bits and pieces of information of this kind as navigational tools for doing better in waking life? I think it's crazy not to use these tools. I think we have a natural God-given radar which enables us to scan our external environment through space and also through time. I've been logging correspondences between dreams and subsequent events in waking life for many, many years, and have collected thousands of examples from my own journals, plus those volunteered to me by others. Some of these are quite trivial. For example, I'm traveling in another country, and I dream that, in a lecture theater, yet again, there's a fan that is so noisy that people cannot hear me speak. When I go back to the United States, I check my next engagements. I drive to a college where I'm giving a talk. I have them turn on the air conditioning. The fan is so noisy that it would have prevented people from hearing me, so I have them move my lecture to another venue. Tiny story, boring, trivial, mundane. I like sharing stories of that kind. Why? Because people have got themselves into the superstitious belief that dreams about the future are all about death and disaster. Not so. We have this natural radar. Issues large and small, events tiny and large, pop up on that screen. If you can learn to use your dream radar, hone your ability to identify the objects that come up on it, you can make better choices. You can literally change your future for the better. Because the neat thing is not simply to dream about the future, but to use that dream material to change the future when you don't like it. Dreams of the future are often dreams of possible futures. You can change the future if you know how to use the information, which starts with being willing to recognize and record it. So, scouting the future, rehearsing for future challenges, is one of the great, great benefits of active dreaming. There are many others. Another is that through dreams, we come into contact with that vital creative source. We get new perspectives on how we can look at things, how we can tackle things. We get direct inspiration for creative endeavors of every kind. I'm not just talking about the visual arts or writing or scientific discovery. Hostesses dream a great new menu for a dinner party. I know a plumber who won't work on a complicated job before he dreams on it and feels that he saves himself a great deal of time by figuring out in his dreams how to handle the project. You can, as you become a conscious dreamer, travel to a dream location. We will explore this as a technique, where you can meet with a master teacher in your own field and receive training and instruction from that person. So dreams as a tool for creative discovery, for releasing your own full creativity. This is part of the wonder of dreaming. Wherever living spirituality exists, I think that conscious dreaming, under various names, is recognized as a vital part of the art of dying, of preparing for the transitions of soul and spirit after physical death. Through dreams, we have encounters with ancestors, departed loved ones, and spiritual teachers. Through these encounters, we can learn about life after life and prepare ourselves for the conditions of the afterlife as we enter the death walk in our own lives, as we enter the state of preparation for leaving the physical plane. Through active dreaming, we can rehearse for the conditions of what may lie beyond physical existence for us. This is another of the vital gifts of dreaming. I think of active dreaming as a process of soul remembering, of bringing back knowledge about our identity and purpose that may have belonged to us before we came into this incarnation. It's characteristic of us as humans to forget and remember and forget again. William Blake wrote, "The wise man falleth down 7 times a day and getteth up again." Someone in one of my workshops said, "That's all very well, but what if you falleth down 7 times a day and getteth up only 6.5? Well, in dreams, we remember. We get up again. We begin to remember who we are. We begin to discover the connection between the little self and the big self. When I'm asked what all of this is truly about, I tend to offer one of two descriptions. I might say active dreaming is fundamentally about play, about approaching life in a spirit of divine play, about living spontaneously and generously and passionately and finding great new games to work with. Or I might say, not on a more somber note, but on a slightly different note, that it is fundamentally about reintroducing the little self to the big self, who also speaks to us through dreams. There's a great story about that from a shamanic culture I would like to leave with you as part of this introduction. The story comes from the Maquiritari of Venezuela, and it is a story of their first shaman, a strong dreamer called Medatia. This is a story shared with shamans-to-be, with dreamers and wannabe dreamers, in this particular dreaming tradition. The story goes that back close to the beginning of things, humans lost their connection with the spiritual world. There was a rift between earth and sky, and humans ceased to be able to communicate with the spiritual beings. And in their darkness and confusion, they fell very low. Humans lived with water snakes and with wild pigs, and they thought they were water snakes and wild pigs. They forgot that they had human identities. They forgot that they had human souls. And in this time of darkness and forgetting, the great dreamer Medatia began to dream very strongly. He dreamed so strongly that he went swirling round and around in his room, and he whirled up through the roof of his hut, following a spiral path, a vortex that carried him all the way up to the upper world in his powerful dream. When he arrived in the upper world, he could not understand what was going on about him until his sight and his hearing were changed, and he was cleansed in a pond of electric blue fire. When his sight and his hearing were changed, he was able to begin to explore the other worlds, and this great dreamer, Medatia, traveled in all to 9 different levels of the upper world, and he made astonishing discoveries. He found on each of the 9 levels of the upper world a counterpart of himself. He found a higher being, different from himself and yet not separate from himself, separate from himself and yet not different, if you prefer. And finding his connection with these counterpart beings on the 9 levels of the upper world, having changed his sight and his hearing and his understanding and being cleansed in that pool of blue fire, he was able to integrate into himself their knowing, their understanding. He brought it back in the form of shaman songs, and he traveled down his spiral path the other way back to the physical plane. And knowing what he now knew about the destination of the soul and the identity of his people, he was able to call his people back to the true way. And he did this in a very interesting fashion. By night, the shaman called the dream souls of his people to him one by one out of their bodies and trained and instructed them in the nature of their identity and their purpose. And when he sent back each dream soul to the body of the sleeper, the dream soul informed the brain and the body of the sleeper what it had learnt. And each time a person woke up from this night escapade with the great shaman, he or she remembered that they were human, that they had souls, that they had a larger purpose. And they walked back from the swamps of the water snakes and the wallows of the wild pigs, and they started to live fully and generously as humans. Isn't that a great story? It tells us all sorts of things about dreaming, about the nature of higher worlds, but above all in this connection, about the relationship between the little self and the big self, about reawakening to our connection with teachers who may be counterparts of ourselves on higher planes, separate and yet not different, or different and yet not separate. This is what dreaming is about. It's about soul remembering.